The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. During the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the National Geographic Traveler, the News and Observer, Virtuoso Life, and AAA Go Magazine. On today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin our journey on two wheels from the Obsessions column of the February-March 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. Writer Mark Jenkins tells us about urban biking, the big deal about wheels, as more cities and travelers are discovering a passion for pedaling. This summer, I was in New York City for several days, and rather than rent a car or take cabs, buses, or the subway, I rented a bicycle, a mere $24 for a three-day pass. My hotel was in Midtown on 57th Street near Central Park. The first day, I had a morning meeting at Columbia University in Upper Manhattan, clear out on 116th, then a dinner engagement with my wife downtown in Little Italy. Because the world's most famous city has finally fully embraced bicycling, I wheeled from my hotel all the way to Columbia on a designated bike path, west on 55th, up 8th Avenue, arcing around Columbus Circle, then along beautiful flight north on Central Park West, whizzing past taxis stalled in traffic. It couldn't have been easier. On the return, I cruised south for 120 blocks through the verdant tunnels of Central Park and West Drive onto Broadway, then 4th Avenue to Lafayette, arriving at a classic Italian diner with a healthy appetite. I spent more than 2 days in New York City, never trapped in traffic gridlock or descending into the dungeons of the greasy subway. What's more, I wasn't the only one. Everyone, not just tourists, seemed to have suddenly realized the utter beauty and unsung utility of bicycles. I saw women in blue business suits with briefcases strapped to their bikes, construction workers with tool bags hanging from their panniers, young hipsters on neon wheels, a woman in stilettos and a scarf pumping through Greenwich Village. H.G. Wells once wrote, "Every time I see an adult on a bicycle, I no longer despair for the future of the human race." The bicycle is the most efficient form of transportation ever devised. If one converts calories to gasoline, a bicycle gets 1,000 miles per gallon, the average American car, 25. In terms of traveling green, as you might expect, the difference between renting a car and riding is profound. According to the EPA, carbon dioxide accounts for 95 to 99% of automobile-generated global warming emissions, and your typical rental car spews out almost 1 pound of CO2 per mile. In New York, if one out of 20 people switched from taxis and private cars to bicycles and public transportation, it would save 150 million pounds of carbon dioxide emissions a year, the equivalent of planting a forest 1.3 times the size of Manhattan Island. But what about time, the uber currency of urban travel? Well, actually, it turns out it's faster to bicycle a mile or two in Manhattan, as well as in many other U.S. cities, than it is to take a taxi, bus, or subway. No surprise to anyone who has stared out a dirty window at bicyclists whizzing by. The average American commuter spends 42 hours a year stuck in traffic. So why aren't more Americans bicycling, especially when they visit cities? In fact, they are. In the past decade, the number of people riding bikes has doubled. More than 100 million Americans rode a bike in 2014, and 45 million used their bicycle for transportation. Hundreds of cities across the United States, D.C. to Denver, Salt Lake City to San Diego, Austin to Atlanta, are building bike paths. New York City has added 54 miles of bike lanes every year since 2007. Chicago has added 27 miles of bikeways annually since 2011. Some 70% of American mayors would prefer more bike paths than more car lanes or parking lots. In 2015, Minneapolis became the first American city to be listed among the world's top bike-friendly communities. Its Midtown Greenway, a 5.5-mile bicycle path, once a railroad corridor, is open 24/7, lit at night, and plowed during the winter. It has thousands of daily users. In 2014, Atlanta won a prestigious Environmental Rehabilitation Award for its revitalization of the Beltline, a 33-mile greenway, also once a railroad track, specifically for bicycling and walking. And this bicycle revolution is global. In the last year, I traveled to Manila, Chengdu, and Bogota, renting bicycles in each city. Bogota had the best bicycle paths of them all, over 200 miles. This fall, I was traveling in Europe and rented a bicycle in a half dozen cities, Amsterdam, naturally, and Paris, but also Berlin and Milan. As one dapper cyclist told me outside the magnificently ornate Milan Cathedral, there is only one way to really see any city. That is to bicycle. Writer William Soroya called the bicycle the noblest invention of mankind. I would add that it is also the most humane. On my last evening in New York City, I pedaled simply for pleasure from one neighborhood to the next. The sun on my face, the smell of pasta in the air, kids kicking a soccer ball, teenagers laughing, someone playing a saxophone. There is nothing quite so joyous as gliding along on two wheels. And there's some Urban Biking's latest revolution additions to this article. After gearing up in China, dockless bike share companies are rolling out in the United States and Europe as more accessible and affordable options to traditional city bike share programs. And by the way, I'll interject here, Raleigh also has a bike share program going on in the downtown area. U.S.-based companies like Lime Bike, Spin and Jump, Brighton cities such as Seattle, Dallas, Zurich, and Frankfurt with their colorful bike frames. Headquartered in China, both Mobike and Ofo put pep into pedaling in cities from D.C. to Beijing. Most dockless rentals run about a dollar for 30 minutes. Riders simply download an app, locate a nearby bike, and use their smartphones to unlock and pay for their bike. To pay for their ride, and then parking the bike at their final destination, rather than strolling city streets to find a station with available docks. So right on, writes Alexandra Petrie, who's also assisting in this article, Obsessions Urban Biking. Well, our original guide and author, Mark Jenkins, is the writer in residence at the University of Wyoming today. He's also a contributing editor and writer to National Geographic Traveler. I want to keep in mind that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the excursions that may be mentioned in the articles we read on Armchair Traveler. They are selected for your enjoyment and edification. And next, we're going to read an article by Adam Eres, who takes us to Houston, where they are cooking with gas. Diversity and down-home hospitality spark a culinary boom in Houston. His article's from the January-February 2018 issue of Virtuoso Life magazine. This is a trade publication primarily for persons employed in the travel industry, but usually has lots of interesting information that you might want to enjoy. And Adam writes, when David Chang, king of the New York-based Momofuku Empire, mused what Houston has as the most exciting food scene in America right now, in Virtuoso Life last year, locals likely shrugged, thanks, but tell us something we don't already know. The massive city is a poster child for Lone Star sprawl. The nation's fourth largest by population, 655 square miles, parts of which were devastated by Hurricane Harvey last September, but the city and its restaurant community have proven resilient, and with the Astros winning the World Series for the first time in the team's 56 years, there's reason to celebrate. In Houston, the dining scene can cure cravings for everything from incendiary Szechuan tofu stew to country-fried Wagyu ribeye. It's also an immigrant haven with newcomers and oldcomers from Vietnam, Guatemala, India, Korea, the Philippines, Pakistan, Mexico, and many other countries, and a mayor dedicated to defending Houston's sanctuary city status. That makes for delicious, diverse dining. Another boon, Houston chefs have access to long growing seasons and sterling meats and seafood. Follow Buffalo Bayou, the sluggish river twisting through the city, about 40 miles southeast, and you'll wind up in the Gulf of Mexico. To the north and west of town, the rolling pastures of cattle country, where some of the best barbecue in the country gets its start, stretch to the horizon. And thoughtful cocktail dens, beer halls, and wine halls, or wine bars, I should say, and surprising overall affordability, even the highest-end restaurants seem reasonable, and you don't have a city that might be the country's culinary, that might be, rather, the country's culinary capital. You have a city that already is. Here's where to go. And he's got some little nifty snapshots for us next. Game Changer, 1/5. Some chefs fear change. James Beard Award winner Chris Shepherd craves it, so for his newest restaurant, One Fifth, he baked change right in, a quintet of concepts that will unfold over the course of a five-year lease in the cathedral-like space formerly occupied by fine dining stalwart Mark's. One Fifth premiered last January as a steakhouse and in September pivoted to Romance Languages as a way to focus on cultures that aren't extremely dominant in Houston, explained Shepherd. The menu features family-sized chorizo and shellfish paella cooked in a cast-iron pan, Spain, and torchon foie gras, France, and pasta carbona, or carbona, I should say, carbonara from Italy, enriched with the perfect egg with Shepherd, which Shepherd discovered after a months-long quest. In September, the space will morph into fish fitting as the room's vaulted ceilings create the effect of a dining in a whale's well-appointed ribcage. I have to say, this last paragraph, I don't know who edited this. It's got so many dashes, you have to stop and say, wait a minute, what's this? Anyway, some new creations there. Nonetheless, if you're interested in eating at One Fifth, you'll find it at 1658 Westheimer Road. And they have a website, so check it out at onefifthhouston.com. Just spell out onefifthhouston.com. Going fishing Underbelly, just a few blocks west of One Fifth, Chris Shepherd's five-year-old flagship Underbelly occupies an arc of space with pickle-lined bookshelves and a huge open kitchen with a new focus on seafood. Bringing in whole steer was resulting in an imbalance of beef dishes on a 20-item menu, explains the chef, who sources from the Gulf to the Virginia coast. Fruits of Underbelly's new direction include crispy soft-shell crabs with soba and refreshing chilled vinegar dashi, and meaty golden tilefish on tomato seaweed salad. Talented wine director Matthew Pridgen stocks a cellar full of family-run vineyards and unexpected options such as orange Malvasia, a Texas Vermentino, and a funky white Trousseau, all of which pair beautifully with seafood. Anything by the glass is available in half the pour at half the price, which encourages experimentation. Cap off the meal with a, here we go, now you're going to love this one, Dr. Inhofe drinking vinegar. Late harvest grapes, fortified with spices and herbs, and barrel-aged into sweet and sour tongue twisters. Well, you'll have to travel to 1100 Westheimer Road to check that one out in Houston. And you can get it online, too, not the drink, but at least information, underbellyhouston.com, underbellyhouston.com. How about a little lunch classic? Well, Irma's Original's the place to go. No surface is spared in Knickknack at Irma's Original, a city institution at the bottom of an I-69 off-ramp. As the cheerful clutter, kids' drawings, beer brand neon, wedding photos, toy figurines, or working traffic light fills the multiple dining rooms, so does 77-year-old Irma Galvin's homey Mexican cooking fill the belly. A Brownsville, Texas native of Mexican descent, Galvin opened Irma's in 1982 to support her family after her husband's death and quickly earned a loyal local clientele. Hi, sit anywhere is the no-nonsense greeting you'll likely get from Galvin's daughter, Monica, a fixture of the restaurant. But over the course of a lunch of plump chilies, rellenos, fluffy pork tamales, or enchiladas with red and green sauces, she'll be sending you out free tres leches, sponge cakes, and then hugging you goodbye. You'll find her and all the ingredients at 22 North Chenevert Street. That's 22 North Chenevert Street in Houston. And check it out online at irmasoriginal.com. I-R-M-A-S, irmasoriginal.com. Then there's the Belle of Bel Air, the Mala Szechuan Bistro. Bel Air Boulevard, the multi-lane artery running west out of the city, is the spinal column of Houston's vibrant Asian immigrant community, and on it, Mala Szechuan is the restaurant not to miss. The place is named after the tongue-numbing heat associated with Szechuan peppercorns, deployed here with a precision in dishes such as custardy mapo tofu and popcorn-style fried chicken. The full-throated spice, convivial atmosphere, and wine list stocked with quenching off-dry Riesling draw multi-generational families and chefs on Bel Air field trips and intrepid fire-eaters helping Mala earn a James Beard Award nomination last year. You'll find all these ingredients and fun at 9348 Bel Air Boulevard, 9348 Bel Air Boulevard. No website listed, but again, it's called Mala Szechuan Bistro. And then we have some smoke signals signals out of Killen's STQ. Ronnie Killen has tended pits since 1991 when he and his dad turned an old ice house, that's beer store in Texan, into a barbecue joint called Killen Time. How do you like that for good use of a pun and name? Over the following decades, they spun off several restaurants, including the seminal Killen's Barbecue, and emerged as Houston's first family of barbecue. His latest restaurant, Killen's STQ, is a well-articulated mashup of Westworld looks, wood cladding, saloon doors, and steakhouse fine dining, white tablecloth, studious wine list. Gracing those pristine cloths, says Killen, is the food we've done at events in the past that never found a place in other venues. Or other menus, I should say. Dishes such as molten corn ravioli, country fried ribeye, pork belly gumbo, and a forearm-sized short rib bathed in espresso sauce may sound like an odd menu, mates, but smoke is through the line underpinning STQ's varied, vivid flavors and influences. It gets into everything here, including your clothes. So leave your coat in the car so you don't get the smoke to take home unless you particularly want that. You'll do all that at 2231 South Voss Street in Houston, and you can check him out online at killensstq.com, killenstq.com. And then there's that curry climb, Himalaya. Located in a spiffy little India shopping center, Himalaya serves evocative recipes from Karachi, Pakistan, hometown of Gregorious chef owner Kaiser Lashkari. As the best of awards lining its walls attest, this place is beloved by Houstonians, and on any given day, it's a genuine cross-section of the city's manifold colors and creeds. In addition to Pakistani, North Indian, and Indo-Chinese dishes, Lashkari does fun Texas fusions such as smoked brisket masala and parathadillas. But the best things on the huge menu is the huge, or the hara masala, pastel green curry made with green chilies, yogurt, and cilantro. Yep, you heard that right. Green chilies, yogurt, and cilantro. Scoop it up with lots of blistered naan and fragrant basmati rice. And you can check it all out at 6652 Southwest Freeway. And it's HimalayaRestaurantHouston.com. That's HimalayanRestaurantHouston.com. And that should be Himalaya, not in Himalaya, H-I-M-A-L-A-Y-A, HimalayaRestaurantHouston.com. And then there's the new Q. This is the pit room. You don't have to strain your imagination to figure out the pit room specialty. Halfway down its Montrose neighborhood block, this barbecue stop announces itself with aromas of smoke and barbecue drippings riding the Texas breeze. Served on aluminum trays lined with butcher paper, Chef Branwell Tripp's brisket is heady and lush, but there are a dozen other enticements rounding out the pit room narrative, from the wine list with barbecue, who knew, to the house-made venison sausage that crackles with black pepper and the kick-ass crimson cherry pie, which is sold whole or by the slice, and happens to taste even better late at night in a hotel bathroom. All available, The Pit Room, 1201 Richmond Avenue. Also online, thepitroombbq.com, thepitroombbq.com. And let's talk a little bit more about these Houston things. Here's a tip. One of the hottest neighborhoods in Houston right now is the Heights. Stroll through the Heights Mercantile, a cool new shopping center with a mix of local shops, then enjoy an appetizer and a cocktail around the corner at Better Luck Tomorrow, a new bar from James Beard award-winning chef Justin Yu. And this little review is done by Dasha Westerfield, and she owns a virtuoso agency in Houston. And speaking of Houston hideaways, rent easy after a night on the town. Here's a couple of suggestions. Leather ottomans, tufted headboards, and chase anchor the 232 oil tycoon chic rooms at the St. Regis Houston, located between the River Oaks neighborhood and the Galleria District. For drinking and dining venues include the mahogany-clad Remington Bar, which hosts live music on Friday and Saturday nights. There's also a tranquil spa offering caviar facials and spirulina salt scrubs, among other treatments. Doubles from $250 a night and include breakfast daily and a $100 dining credit. Then Wrought Iron Gates, Shaggy Palms, and a Coral and Banana Paint Job give the 122-room hotel Granduca Houston the look of a seaside European villa. The U-shaped building frames a courtyard pool line with loungers and tented cabanas. On Thursday nights, don't miss Bar Malatesta's Aperitivo Happy Hour, inspired by owner Giorgio Borlini's Italian heritage, for Aperol spritzes and complimentary snacks. Doubles from $225 a night, including breakfast daily, and, again, a $100 dining credit. So lots of activities, lots of fun there in Houston. Well, as we move on, maybe Houston might be a little out of reach for you at the moment. Well, how about something a little closer to home, say Fuquay Arena? Yep. Drew Jackson of the News and Observer unveils some interesting plans in his article, Aviator Brewing to Build a Beer Entertainment Complex, from the November 23rd, 2017 issue of the News and Observer. Last week, Aviator Brewing Company announced a $4.65 million expansion that will move its brewery closer to Fuquay Arena's downtown and create what its owner calls a beer entertainment complex. Adding a concert stage, quick food service, and a distilling operation is a big move for the brewery, which already has seen significant growth since it was founded in 2008. The company does nearly $4 million in sales, according to the town of Fuquay Arena. Moving the brewery creates our own entertainment complex because as the market matures and ages, we've seen beer production collapse, Aviator CEO Mark Dublay said. That's what we wanted to build, a destination and not to be pure production. Aviator will build a 36,000-square-foot brew house on North Street, about a block from the company's other restaurants and shop. The new building will resemble an old airplane hangar as a callback to the company's roots. Aviator was founded in a hangar and over the past decade has increased production, built a tap room, a restaurant, and a bottle shop, and has been one of the greatest driving forces in the growth in Fuquay's downtown. The company will tear down a 109,000-square-foot gold-leaf tobacco warehouse it bought 2 years ago for about $500,000. The expansion will have four bars as well as new brewing equipment and a barrel program. The company's distilling operation, Gold Leaf Distilling, will also make its home in the new Aviator campus. The project is expected to be complete by spring 2019. Doble couldn't say how much more beer Aviator will produce with the expansion, but said it will intentionally remain below North Carolina's 25,000-barrel limit for self-distribution. Mass production, Doble said, could be a thing of the past for craft breweries in North Carolina and beyond, instead focusing on local sales and bringing beer drinkers to the brewery. The expansion will add 75 new full and part-time jobs, with the town contributing $203,250 in incentive funds. The town's contribution will be paid after the capital expenditures have been completed, the town said. Aviator currently brews in a 22,000-square-foot building between Fuquay Arena and Holly Springs. Dublay said the current building will be used to expand the company's catering business. Downtown, Dublay said Aviator will move its existing bottle shop to a space next door to make way for a new pizza restaurant and also add food to the current tap house, making it more of a gastropub. I would like to thank the Fuquay Arena Town Board for believing in the long-term success we have planned for Aviator Brewing Company, Dublay said in a news release. We started our business in an airplane hangar nearly 10 years ago, and now we have grown to become one of the top craft breweries in the U.S., and it's all down the street over in Fuquay Arena if you want to check it out. Well, let me ask you a question here. Have you ever heard of a town called Winnebo? Well, you'll find it just off Highway 17 in Brunswick County. That's south of Wilmington. And you'll need to know that you can so that you can follow what I'm going to read next, written by Mike Marsh, his article called What You Have to Do to Win a Cowboy Fast Draw Shooting Competition. Well, you have to go to Winnebo. That's why you need directions. This is from the September 21st, 2017 issue of the News and Observer. Two gunslingers squared off, hands on the grips of their holstered pistols, trigger fingers itching. They waited for the signal to draw. Myron Bryant drew first, hitting his target and sliding his revolver back into its holster as smoothly as an oiled snake. Instead of the ear-splitting explosion of black powder, 45 cartridge belching smoke, it was an electronic beep that spurred them into action. Since they were shooting wax bullets propelled only by shotgun shell primers, the sound of their guns going off was more like a pop. One thing that was for real was that for the loser, Steve Gregory, it was lights out. "I always like shooting in the club's cowboy action matches," said Myron Bryant, a.k.a. Outcast, a 61-year-old driver for Waste Industries who lives in Leland. "I started shooting cowboy fast draw after I came to one of the cowboy action matches at Buccaneer Gun Club about 6 years ago. I watched The Lone Ranger on TV when I was a kid and always loved shooting single-action revolvers." Gregory, a.k.a. Bull, is a 73-year-old retiree who worked for Caterpillar and lives in Leland. Like Bryant, his revolver was a Ruger Vaquero single action. Competitors must use authentic or replica firearms from the country's Wild West period. "I have been shooting cowboy matches for 25 years, Gregory said. "I shoot SAS cowboy action, fast draw, and wild bunch competitions. I love having a gun on my hip. Drawing it, shooting it is always a thrilling experience. I never get tired of it." Instead of facing each other, the combatants shoot at 24-inch steel discs painted white so their bullets' impact are visible. In the center of each target is a light. The first shooter to hit the target knocks out the light to win the match. The shots are recorded with an electronic timing device, with the time beginning the instant the beeper goes off. A good score to hear the beeper, draw the pistol, cock the hammer, take aim, fire, and for the bullet to hit the target is 0.7 seconds, or in cowboy parlance, a 7, and anything below that time usually wins a two-man duel. The competitors shoot twice against each other, then rotate until they have shot it out with everyone else. The shooter with the best total time, meaning the lowest total number of seconds, wins the overall competition. Cowboy Fast Draw is a sanctioned event under rules established by the Single Action Shooter Society, or SASS, S-A-S-S. Each cowboy must have a nickname or handle and must dress like a cowboy in an old Western movie. This particular branch was one, was one of the Buccaneer Gun Club's monthly fast draw matches, which are held at the club's OK Corral and open to the public. The OK Corral is a covered pavilion built specifically for the fast draw events. The roof protects shooters from the sun and rain. During matches, a white fabric barrier is set up as a bullet stop. "The bullet is moving at about 700 feet per second," said Jeff Holland, a.k.a. Jeff Rowe, a custom home builder from Sneed's Ferry and Buccaneer Gun Club's Cowboy Action Match Director. "I have been seeing matches shot in a Walmart parking lot. It doesn't take much to stop a wax bullet, so it's very safe downrange. The course of fire is two matches at 15 feet, two at 18 feet, and two at 21 feet. Whoever has the fastest time is the overall winner, but the winner doesn't get you much except bragging rights until the next match. Missing can be a humbling experience," he adds. The emphasis is on fun, but not at the expense of safety. Every time two shooters are towing the firing line, a hand judge watches to make sure their hands are on the correct or in the correct position. Holsters must be aligned so that the trigger finger poking through the trigger guard is no farther forward than the seam of the pants, but the bottom of the holster can be tilted. Once they are ready to draw and fire their pistols, the competitors can put their hands on the butt stock, but their index finger must be outside the trigger guard to prevent premature cocking and accidental firing. Even a wax bullet can inflict serious injury at such close range if it hits a cowboy's leg as he's drawing his pistol. A competitor has to win twice to beat the opponent. If both competitors miss the target, they can keep shooting until one of their lights goes out. "It is a challenge of accuracy and speed," Holland said. "You can be the fastest on the draw, but if you don't hit the target, you lose." How about that? All that in Winnebago, North Carolina, and a farming community in Brunswick County. And that's going to bring us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope that you'll be listening next time, that you've enjoyed our travel today. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, the content of our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Broadcast readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.